You're about to hear my conversation with Dustin Reed. We talk all about U.S. politics, what's happening in the election campaign down south. We visit on the Bank of Canada, the reaction to the most recent meeting. We also talk about the Fed and what's going on in the portfolios. I hope you enjoy. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Information relating to investment approaches or individual investments should not be construed as advice or endorsement. Listeners should seek professional advice for their situation. Welcome to The Market Exchange, a podcast from Mackenzie Investments. My name is Matthew Schnurr, and I'm delighted to be back with my regular guest, Dustin Reed. Dustin is our chief fixed income strategist. Dustin, welcome back.
Matt, hey, it's great to be back with you here. Thank you.
We have a lot to cover today, coming on the heels of the Bank of Canada meeting, but I actually wanted to start it on a different foot. I'd love your perspective on the U.S. election. We're just nicely through Super Tuesday. Haley has since stepped down, and I just love what the state of play is in your mind.
Yeah, for sure. So there's been a lot of action on the U.S. election side, and we could probably do a whole hour and then some on it, but maybe just kind of the things I think are really interesting. So obviously, as I'm sure almost everybody would have seen by now, Trump has effectively gained the nomination. He's a few delegates shy here officially, kind of as we record here, 48 hours-ish after Super Tuesday. So he'll need one or two more states to probably make that happen, get over the line, so to speak. But it's very early in the process. Of course, it's not official until the convention. And sure. The Republican convention won't be until the summer. And so that's when it'll be official, but it obviously looks very wrapped up for that intents and purposes. Haley obviously jumping ship here right after Super Tuesday. She did win Vermont, to the surprise of a few people, to be fair, probably mm-hmm. myself included, but obviously lost the vast majority of the states and felt that she couldn't really put forward a winning campaign at this point.
I think she did win the six Republicans in D.C. as well,
if I'm not mistaken. That is also true, yes, where Trump is really not loved too much in D.C., where there are delegates, of course, but they don't technically have a lot of voting power in Congress because sure. it's not represented as a state. So it looks like Trump and it looks like Biden, not to be forgotten. So this would be a rehash in theory of 2020 if nothing changed. A few things could change for sure. I mean, we all know the obvious. These gentlemen are a little older than generally we see for not only U.S. presidents, but elected U.S. presidents. I think Trump's 77 or 78, and Biden's 80 or 81. And that's, of course, ahead of a four-year term, which is not and a relatively stressful term, that is, and being president is a lot of work. We'll see how that goes. I think the interesting thing kind of beyond Super Tuesday is what's happening in parallel with RFK Jr. And I don't think RFK Jr. is going to be winning the election. Let me just state that. But he is campaigning and getting a fair amount of donations from grassroots, from small donations from a lot of people. It is similar to Trump 2016. And I think that's interesting for a few reasons, because if he can get on the ballot in many or most or all of the states, RFK Jr., then he could clearly take votes away from both of the major parties. And for now, I'm just going to assume that that's Trump and Biden. And it may be that, it may not be that. But for the purposes of the next couple minutes, let's just assume that. So what's kind of happening also is that RFK Jr. was at the Libertarian Conference, and there's some discussion, I'll stress some discussion, that he might get on to the Libertarian ticket. And a lot of people would say, okay, well, who cares? That's not really interesting. I think it actually might be interesting, because then he would almost automatically be on the ballot in most, if not all, of 50 states automatically. And right now he's on a huge signature campaign to try and get on ballots for November in the states. And so, as you can imagine, getting signatures to qualify is a Herculean effort, and sure. it's very, very manual. It takes a lot of time. I mean, it's already March. Elections obviously in November. So if he were to be the Libertarian candidate, he would, in theory, be able to be on a lot of ballots. And that's interesting, because that could really take votes away from Trump and or Biden. And what that could mean is maybe he wins a few states. And if that does happen and the Trump-Biden breakdown for the Electoral College is really, really close, it is possible, although unlikely, but it is possible that no candidates reach 270 Electoral College votes, 270. Right, there are 538 to be had, 538. So you need 270 to win. If you don't have 270, then in theory, or no one has 270, I should say, then and I'll probably skip the minutiae detail here, but the process then moves to the House of Representatives, and then there's a voting process, and there are a certain number of people that can be included, and then there's a there's a process for vice president as well. Anyway, I think that's really interesting. I think the probability of that is not base case, to be fair, but I think it's not a small tail risk at this point, because there's been a lot of interaction between RFK and the Libertarians, and we'll know, I think, by May if RFK is going to be on the Libertarian ticket,
right.
Because the Libertarian convention, I believe, is in May, like the other two big conventions are in the summer. So we'll probably know. So something to watch. I mean, obviously, some people in the Libertarian Party are not super thrilled with that idea. I mean, obviously, he is, RFK. So he has comes from a long line of Democrat family. That's obviously arguably the big family for Democrats in the U.S. And he switched out of that already once away from a Democrat to being independent, and he could do it again. But he does line up with Biden on a few issues, I believe, around things like guns and things like that, which are not overly libertarian in the way that libertarians, I believe, view that policy, and there are other policies as well. So it's not a slam dunk by any stretch. And I think there are people that in the Libertarian Party that would be thrilled, and there I think there would be people that would not be overly thrilled, maybe from a policy platform. So anyway, I think that's interesting. I think our listeners should kind of just keep that in the back of their mind as we work through the remainder of Q1 and into Q2. And everyone talks about, okay, could be a little bump in the road and what could happen with Trump or Biden, a little bit older and that sort of thing. I wouldn't push back on that. I think that that's totally fair, but that's another layer of potential complexity and interest, I think, in the election that people might want to be aware of. That's kind of beyond the usual headlines that we've been seeing for a long time on kind of the two big candidates.
So it sounds to me the increase in probability of really not knowing who the two running candidates could be, and also what that looks like when you add in the third party.
That's right. Yeah,
fair enough. And what implications does that have? Like, how do you tie that back to sort of markets or tie it back to what's likely to happen in various scenarios? Or is it just what you're saying is the ability to predict is just becoming more and more difficult?
So I generally like to think that unknowns are the worst for markets, broadly speaking, cross asset. I can deal with good news. I can deal with bad news even if I don't want to. What I don't want to deal with is unknowns and what's going to happen. And so if for whatever reason it went to the House and it looked like a bit of a bun fight between the House to actually get somebody elected, that is where, from just a general risk sentiment, global risk sentiment perspective, I would be concerned around not the long term or even the medium term, but clearly there could be some risk around risk sentiment, so to speak, in the short term, and that would be an issue. Well, and then there's kind of like the layer above that, which is the easy example is obviously Ross Perot in '92, probably taking the majority of his votes from George H.W. Bush. I mean, Clinton probably is not elected in '92 without Ross Perot. And so does that if what I was saying a few minutes ago with RFK, does it RFK Jr. does that have could that have a spoiler impact on either candidate? Originally, I would say last year, maybe mid year when RFK Jr. was really getting a little bit of momentum, people thought it would take away from Trump. But the latest over the last two or three months from a polling perspective seems to suggest that it's taking away from from Biden. So from a market's perspective, you know, there's kind of the usual implications, right? So deregulation under Trump, maybe a little bit more energy friendly, clearly not as China friendly or likely under Trump, and, you know, vice versa under Biden, presumably. You know, defense spending probably increases under Trump a little bit more. Obviously, Congress counts here too in terms of what can get appropriated and passed. The green energy initiatives, ESG initiatives, obviously have a better chance of continuing under Biden than right. Trump. You know, so those are the usual, you know, the usual market implications. I think it's also interesting just maybe to tie one more thing in here. The last polling data I saw. Basically, seven swing states in for the election. So, think of the Midwest blue wall. So, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, two in the Southwest. So that'll be Arizona, Nevada, mm-hmm. and then two kind of Southeast, Georgia, and then that's six. And then the seventh that people talk about is North Carolina. So those are the seven that are kind of, I mean, everything's up for grabs, but those are the ones that I think are really up for grabs in terms of swing states. And when you look at the latest polling data, when you include RFK as a third party candidate, maybe not a libertarian candidate, but a third party candidate, as well as a couple of the other very, very small players, like almost like a five-way race, so to speak. So this isn't just head-to-head. Trump is winning in at least six of those seven swing states by the last I saw, and there might be newer data since I saw it, but this might be a week ago, anywhere from 3 to 10 percentage points in the ones that he's winning. Pennsylvania seems to be a little bit more, maybe slightly skewed toward Biden, but it's ever so slightly skewed and definitely within the margin of error. So that's why when you read these headlines, you know, if the election was held tomorrow, Trump would very likely win. That's basically based off that polling data. Right. And so spending a lot of time, obviously, watching kind of the blue wall. You know, Dan Clifton, who we've had on the Get Sharp podcast here, who I think's great, thinks that the blue wall is very, very important. So Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. I remember hearing Jim Messina in DC a couple months ago saying that the road, it sounds a little wild, but the road through for the election runs through Milwaukee, i.e. like okay. The Wisconsin is really the battleground state and kind of the bellwether of which way things are going to go. So keep an eye on that, on those six or seven states. That's what I would say to listeners in terms of where Trump is polling. But yeah, from a market's perspective, it's too early to probably make those decisions. And those allocations, because we need to know more about, I think, the third party candidates and what kind of impact that could have. But, you know, and the further we get into this, the more it looks like the Trump could be the winner. But anything is possible, obviously, this far out.
As you said, we could do a whole hour on it. So why don't we call it there on on U.S. Election? Let's move to the Bank of Canada. You referenced GetSharp with Dan Clifton. We just recorded an episode yesterday where the headline from the Bank of Canada meeting was a nothing burger. Yeah. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's totally nothing, but it was definitely not. It was not a significant meeting in the sequencing of how the meetings are probably going to go this year and versus a lot of the meetings that we've had over the last couple of years, to be sure. The bank's formal statement, the last paragraph in the formal statement went, I mean, every word's important, but the last paragraph is the most important. And it was essentially a carbon copy of what we got in January. And that's a very big tell of, you know, things haven't really changed that much, or at least our views on the way things are, evolving haven't really changed that much. So from that perspective, yeah, not a big deal per se. We got a little bit more detail in the press conference around how the bank might be looking at the many core inflation indices, with Macklem really backing up the idea of the two that are still very much in play, mean and trimmed. And that seems to be the bank seems to be leaning that way. But Macklem also talked about headline on its own, which is the bank's target metric, and then headline X shelter, and then of course the old CPIX, which those of us that have been following this for a while is kind of the old core measure. So it makes it a little challenging because there's, I mean, I just rhymed off five, well, including headline CPI six, but five core metrics, five core CPI metrics there, right? So what do you pay attention to? What's the bank paying attention to? You know, what's the skew? Is it all of it? What's the weighting? It makes it a little more challenging to figure out kind of what the bank is looking at from a reaction policy perspective. In theory, it should be looking at headline inflation because that is its target, 1-3% for headline inflation. And headline inflation in Canada has slowed for the most recent print down to 2.9%. So it's the first time in a little bit we've been kind of inside the range, although the very top end of that range, obviously 1-3% on an annual basis. But so a little bit of detail around that I think was interesting. Maybe interesting was, you know, what wasn't said. I think there were a few people, I would probably include myself in this camp, thinking that the bank might set the table at the March meeting, the meeting we just had for April, which is a forecast round. But that clearly, I mean, I think it's possible, but that clearly did not happen. And that was not the MO going into either the statement or the press conference that we got. So a bit of a holding pattern. And you're seeing a bit of a convergence, I would say, of not only market expectations, but also central bank speak around the June meetings, so to speak, whether right. that's here domestically, Bank of Canada, Fed, ECB, maybe not Bank of Japan, to be fair, but Bank of England, those majors seem to be coalescing around the June meeting. So I think, you know, from a headline perspective, yeah, it was a little bit of a nothing, but there's always information to be gleaned. And sometimes, you know, the things that are said are not as important as the things that were not said. And, you know, those are some of the things that I took away from the BOC for the March meeting.
Maybe we'll turn to the Fed. You've referenced sort of market expectations adjusting. Clearly, that's happened in the U.S. as well as other markets coming into the year. Lots of anticipated rate cuts. It seems like those have pared back and we're more closely aligned to the dot plot. Talk me through your thoughts on U.S. market and where we go from here for the balance of the year.
For sure. So there's so much on the Fed. I would say that in November, we started to pick up this idea that the Fed was really looking at real rates and the market could look at real rates, real interest rates. And real rates still are and were quite high. And we thought the market would trade pretty significantly, moving from around 80-ish basis points in terms of easing for the Fed for 2024 to maybe 150. And it did, and surpassed that to about 165 or 170, I think, in the round on in terms of peak. And that was something we then thought maybe they could do even more than that. But the data has clearly, in January and February, come in, and even December, come in pretty hot. Not only the prices data, but the activity data in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. economy is doing very, very well. And these stories of U.S. exceptionalism, I think there's truth to it from an economics perspective. It clearly, the growth in the U.S. is surpassing basically almost anywhere else in the world for probably a number of reasons. So that easing that was priced in by the market for 2024 got wound back by a significant amount, probably about 90 basis points, going from around 170 to about 80 basis points. We've since bounced a little bit higher, but it's a big repricing. Interestingly, you know, that's all happening during the first couple months of the year, when I'm sure everybody who's listening knows equities have done, at least U.S. equities, but generally equities across the globe have done exceptionally well.
Right.
Many, many record highs, you know, printed in the U.S. and in other regions as well. So it's a little odd, right? Or at least that you wouldn't expect that. You wouldn't expect a significant amount of rate easing getting taken out of the market and equities to consistently print all-time highs. So that's kind of an interesting thing, and we can talk about that maybe if there's time. But I think from a Fed perspective here, the Fed is starting to think about. I mean, it's obviously always thinking about the cadence and what it should be doing from an easing perspective, but it's clearly not comfortable yet easing rates. Yeah, I think they're very concerned that easing rates will create a bit of a bubble in terms of prices, particularly service prices for services, and inflation will bounce back higher, and the Fed will end up doing exactly what it said it didn't want to do when it got into this, which is repeat the 1970s and kind of easing and then hiking and then easing and then hiking and back and forth. And it's very uncertain, and it's just not, it's not constructive for a number of reasons. I think we've talked about that on a previous podcast or two. So we have a Fed meeting in a few weeks. The December forecast round, which is the last forecast round, had 75 basis points penciled in for easing for 2024 by the Fed. There's some talk that that could be raised by 25 basis points to 50. It's pretty close. It'll be tough to tell. I'm more confident that the 2025 estimate, when we get that in March, will be raised. Currently, if you just look at what's expected for 24 and what's expected for 25 by the Fed, not by the market, but by the Fed expects to do an additional 100 basis points of easing in 2025 over 2024, basically taking, you know, the median dot for 2025 versus the median dot in 2024. I think that 100 basis points of easing in 25, that median dot, that has a higher probability of coming higher back to 75 basis points. And maybe they tweak 2026 as well. Why? Because the economy clearly seems to be outperforming almost all expectations for a myriad of reasons. And I would say prices are, I mean, clearly they're well off the peak, but they are sticky and some would argue structural. And I'm sure there are some participants and everyone who participates at the senior level has a say around the dots. It's not just voters, but it's the participants. I'm sure there are many participants, both voter and non-voter, that are concerned that 100 basis points in easing in 25 might be a little too much. But the market's already there, essentially. So I'm not totally convinced that it's going to be a huge reaction function for the market. Okay. Although it could be, because what generally happens is, you know, the market will extrapolate small tweaks or changes. So it's, we're cognizant of that and watching that. The other thing I would mention on the Fed before maybe wrapping up this one is a speech a couple of weeks ago from Vice Chair Jefferson, who we don't hear from too often. And the speech was interesting, not to sound too weedy or academic, but he talked about the 94-95, called the mid-90s cycle. And I don't love looking at historical cycles to figure out what's going to happen now, because the market's changed and liquidity's changed and everything's changed. But if the Fed's referencing it, then it's at least worth a look. From that perspective, Vice Chair Jefferson said that the 1995 cycle was the perfect soft landing.
Okay.
So that's interesting. Because if the Fed is thinking, and a very senior person at the Fed, the vice chair, or one of the vice chairs, if the vice chair is thinking that that cycle was the perfect soft landing, just by chance, what did the Fed do during that cycle? Well, the Fed did not ease at every consecutive meeting. The Fed paused between rate cuts, two or three meetings for a number of meetings. And so that is the latest kind of idea or thought process in terms of Fed sequencing here, you know, as we kind of start to round out Q1 and what does 2024 look like from an easing pace perspective, getting back to your question, because there's definitely some thought, and I'm spending a lot of time thinking about it too, around what I would call non-sequential easing by the Fed, assuming we get liftoff in June, let's say. And obviously the election later this year might complicate that a little bit.
Sure.
So there's a few dynamics at play, obviously. But I think that that's an interesting thing. And I'm looking for more references from voters and non-voters alike to the 95 cycle. Because if we see a lot of commentary around the 95 cycle that clearly suggests that a number of people are looking at that as not necessarily the blueprint, but they are skewing towards cutting at every other meeting, every three meetings, but clearly not every meeting consecutively. And I think that's important for markets, because there is clearly an expectation that the Fed will ease maybe not as much as before, but that's clearly boosting risk sentiment, risk assets, you know, earnings, equity valuations. Obviously, credit is doing very well, you know, very tight, both in the IG and the high yield space, and just, you know, sovereign fixed income, where I obviously spend a lot of my time, emerging market fixed income. So if there's a bit of a change in terms of that thought process, and people aren't as comfortable having that much risk, higher risk assets in their portfolio, clearly that would be significant. Although there are other drivers, I think, kind of beyond the fundamentals that are important, that that we should all be keeping in mind, particularly the, you know, all the market that's stuck on the sidelines around like GIC money, sure, money market funds, right, money, particularly in the States. You know, I think when the Fed and other central banks do start easing, which I do think it will happen this year, not all, but a lot of that money is probably going to find another home. And, you know, where is it going to go? And I think that that, you know, that could be very, very interesting, probably constructive for fixed income and possibly for equities as well.
Makes a lot of sense. As you sort of synthesize all of these views, how do you reflect them in the portfolio?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to watch and a lot to think about, for sure.
Sure.
The big steepening trade that we've been watching and in a little bit in a roundabout way for a while clearly has taken a pause here, right? Because we've gone from big easing expectations to moderate easing expectations.
Right.
And so you've seen the curve flatten out, so to speak. So by that, I mean kind of the front end moving a little bit higher, repricing in higher, kind of the higher for longer idea, with the back end, also maybe not moving as high. So it's flattening of the curve. You know, this January data coming out of the US, particularly the CPI print for January that we got in February, was quite hot on a number of fronts. The super core number was big. The regular headline and core numbers were pretty significant. And it definitely scared a lot of people away from the duration trade. And that has generally been the trade here, although the last four or five trading days, you know, from where we're recording now, we've seen a little bit of a bid for duration. So prices higher, yields lower. But the broad trend has been, you know, people have been scared of, you know, buying fixed income in particular. I've been concerned since January about the February prices data, and it's one of the reasons I haven't been advocating to buy duration yet in the portfolio, particularly in North America. Obviously we have benchmarks and overweights and, you know, certain things, but in terms of having big tactical or structural alpha trades on in duration, holding back on that for the moment, one of the drivers or one of the reasons, rationales, is that I think the February prices data that we get throughout this month, March, is going to continue to be hot. I think it'll be directionally the same. I don't know if the amplitude or the size, like the size of the number, is going to be quite the same, but I think it'll be hot enough that people are going to sit back and say, well, look at January data, and maybe that wasn't an aberration, and now look at the February data. This is the beginning of a trend. I'm not comfortable here. And obviously, it matters what the Fed thinks, of course, and we'll see what the Fed does say about that, if that idea or that, you know, theory does come to pass. But I think we need to move through that for a little bit. So as I've been saying to the team, I guess, where are we here? So we are in week five of a 3 to 7 week reset period on rates. Now, we have seen a bit of a bid, like I said a minute ago, for duration. We saw 10-year treasuries from a yield perspective bounce off of 433, 435, at least twice, if not three times. And so a lot of technical, there's a little bit of technical trading happening there, and some CTA, commodity trading advisors that are very momentum focused kind of come in after it 10-year yields couldn't really move above 435 and start buying. So prices higher, yields lower. And so we've seen 10-year yields move from kind of right there, 433, let's say, to down to 410, maybe below 410. But I am a little hesitant ahead of this, the CPI data that we get in the next few weeks, PPI and obviously PC, in particular core PC, which is obviously the Fed's main metric. So that's kind of obviously any fixed income portfolio. Duration is a very important, and getting the duration call correct is a very big part of that. So that's kind of where we are. I mean, I still say we are, generally speaking, overweight North America versus rest of world. I think Europe is interesting. particularly with the ECB meeting this morning. I think there's a chance that the ECB could outdove the Fed this year. And the market, frankly, is pricing that too, but I'm not convinced that the market's actually pricing that enough. So I think European duration, giant German benchmark, looks interesting here, maybe just as interesting as North America. And that's something that I think we're going to continue to think about. I think, you know, we've been generally a little bit overweight North American duration, but obviously the Canadian side is an important driver and factor to that. And given what happened at the bank, or what didn't happen at the bank, so to speak, as we just talked about a few minutes ago, you know, there's definitely internationally, from what I pick up, international clients, non-Canadian clients, or at least non-North American clients, really believe that Bank of Canada really needs to ease pretty significantly, and more so than the Fed. And Jason Dahr, our guest on Get Sharp, spoke about this yesterday, and I would agree with that. With just people that I speak with outside of North America, it's still very much a prevailing. Very much prevailing view. So, like, that's kind of the North American, you know, trades, for example, and then obviously the European side. We still have this JGB trade, which we like, I know, a fair bit. We'd like it a little bit more on a spread basis as opposed to an alpha basis. There's a BOJ, Bank of Japan meeting in the days before the Fed meeting. So we'll get it kind of late night on Monday, the 18th. Fed meeting will be the afternoon of the 20th of March. Wednesday, the 20th of March. And there's a lot of talk that the Bank of Japan will hike rates for the first time in a very, very long time at the March meeting. I mean, since October or November, I've been thinking about April as liftoff, and it's kind of been a bun fight between April and March for a while. But there's been some data, some speak from the central banks, as well as some articles that probably are well sourced that are talking about March. So assuming a 10 basis point hike, which is probably the first hike by the Bank of Japan, going from minus 10 basis points to zero, there's basically right now an 80% probability that the bank will hike at the March meeting. So we'll see. I mean, really, in the long run, it doesn't really matter whether they hike in March or April. It's going to be a very, very slow hiking cycle. And a lot of people, I would say myself included, really only expect the bank to hike one more time after they do 10, either in March or April, probably 25 in late summer or early fall. And, you know, the spread trade, I think, for JGBs versus North America makes some sense on a pure alpha basis. I mean, it makes probably a little less sense, although, you know, it depends on exactly how your portfolio is measuring up. From a pure alpha perspective, there's probably a little bit more juice left in it, but the juice that we thought was going to be in it, particularly around the turn in 22 and 23 and most of the first half of 23, that rationale is probably not quite there as much. So it's more portfolio management and managing duration, having some short duration and managing it against kind of being overweight North American duration. That's a lot for our core funds. That's how we spend a lot of time thinking about the JGB trade and kind of managing the overall duration as opposed to just pure alpha. So now those are some of the things that we're looking at. Obviously, the credit stuff's very interesting. Like I was saying before, credit remains very, very tight. Earnings are doing, you know, quite well. The defaults are low. U.S. economy is, you know, booming. Labor market is still relatively tight. You know, so we continue to be relatively constructive on certain parts of the credit market. And emerging markets continues to be a favored trade for us, particularly in our global funds and our unconstrained funds, because you know, the coupon, particularly in Mexico and Brazil, are so rich from a real rates perspective, and we like clipping that coupon. We think it's a great trade, particularly for Canadian investors who have a pseudo natural hedge as a Canadian dollar as a base currency. So those are some of the big views in terms of particularly, I would say, macro, the macro views that we still have in the portfolio. And it'll definitely be a very interesting year with the election, the presumed rate cut cycle, and I'm sure some geopolitics stuff on the side.
Well, I look forward to having you back on to guide us through the rest of the exciting year ahead. So thanks so much for spending time with us today, Dustin. I really appreciate your insights.
That sounds great, Matt. Thanks for having me.
The content of this podcast, including facts, views, opinions, and recommendations, is not to be used or construed as investment advice and is not an offer or an invitation to buy or sell any security. content of this podcast should not be relied upon for any purposes, and Mackenzie Financial Corporation is not responsible for any reliance upon it. This podcast includes forward-looking information that reflects our current expectations or forecasts of future events. Forward-looking information is subject to risks, uncertainties, and assumptions that could cause actual results to differ materially from those expressed herein. Our views are subject to change based on market conditions. Commissions, trailing commissions, management fees, and expenses may be associated with mutual fund investments. Please read the fund facts and prospectus before investing. The indicated rates of returns are historical annual compounded total returns, including changes to unit values and reinvestment of all dividends or distributions, and does not take into account sales, redemptions, distribution, or optional charges or income taxes payable by any security holder that would have reduced returns.